Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone.
Right, a whole lot of police cars, indeed. It's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable growl of Humphrey Bogart portraying that idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop the presses. My name's Tom Robbins, and I've taken the title of that fine movie for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. So what's happened to all those once great newspapers of America's cities, like the one we were just heard roaring through the presses, edited by the Humphrey Bogart character, Ed Hutchison, in that movie? Well, technology, the internet, decline in advertising, those are the usual suspects, and that's not wrong. But there's also plenty of blame to go around on the part of the people who publish newspapers, along with the editors and, yeah, even the reporters. I think as good a person as any to ask about what's gone right and what's gone wrong in newspapers is Clem Richardson, who's worked at a whole bunch of them. We're going to talk about that along with a bunch of his own tales from a long career in the news business. I don't think Clem Richardson is probably your usual newsman. He's a big man with a wide smile and a big laugh, which you'll probably hear in a moment or two. Clem and I worked in the same newsroom at the Daily News for a few years in the 1990s, and I can tell you he stood out, not just because he was probably the most popular guy and a big guy, but for one thing, he was always a picture of calm. He never seemed to get rattled like the rest of us, no matter how tight the deadline pressures or how loudly the editors snapped at us. That might have had something to do with the fact that he's a master of Aikido, I believe, the martial art, but I can tell you that's not the usual profile of a newspaper person. Clem comes from Charleston, South Carolina, which may also add to that more relaxed take in the newsroom. His first paper was the Anderson Independent in Anderson, South Carolina. And before he landed in New York, he did a tour of some of the nation's best newspapers. He worked for the Atlanta Constitution, later the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Miami Herald, before he was hired by New York Newsday in the 1980s. And he worked there until the fools pulled the plug on that great paper in 1993 when he moved over to the Daily News, which is when I met him. At the News, Clem was an editor on the city desk, edited the old Brooklyn Borough section, and then got what he calls the best damn job in journalism, writing columns about the city and great people. He also took time out from the newsroom to teach journalism on a fellowship in South Africa after Nelson Mandela became president. He's worked in the business when newspapers were healthy and fat, and he's there when they've gotten anemically thin. And he's got some, I think, pretty excellent perspective on where newspapers may have gone off track. Welcome, Clem. Are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, Tom, for the introduction, man. I felt like I should go get a drink or something or give myself an award. Thank you.
So listen, at the news, the Daily News, you had two different columns. One of them was called City Beat and another called Great People. Two great names for columns. And the column did just that. It introduced New Yorkers to the beat of the city and many of its great people. And the other day you called it just what I said, the greatest damn job in journalism. What made it so great, Clem?
Look, man, I mean, you know, let me see, back in the 80s, I was all of what, I think I was in my late 30s, early 40s. Well, you know, you get to walk around the greatest city in the country, if not in the world, and just call people and say, hey, can I come by and talk to you? And they're happy to see you. I got to just meet so many amazing people. I met folks who were making history, folks who were historic icons, like, in fact, you know, it's funny, after we spoke the other day, I decided to make a list of them. I interviewed Evelyn Cunningham, who had covered the civil rights era down in the South, and she was in her 90s when I interviewed her. Mm. I interviewed World Court Judge Gus Reichbach, who lived right here in Brooklyn down.
Gus Reichbach, downtown. What's his name? Yes,
really indeed. Nice guy, Reichbach. He's real nice. Gus was a real nice guy. Of course, I spent a lot of time with writer Albert Murray, who was just a scary, brilliant one of these folks who you're talking to. I remember we were sitting in his house. He said, go get that book over there. And he pointed, and he had a bookcase, maybe, you know, a couple of hundred, maybe 1,000 books up on the side of the wall. And he put that red book right there. And I got the book down. I'm holding it. He said, open the page, such and such. I opened the page, and he starts quoting the page. To me, I'm reading the page. He's quoting the page. I mean, the guy was just scary, brilliant. Somebody put Carolyn Cassidy Kent, who founded the Landmarks Committee for the Manhattan Community Board 9, met me over at the Church of St. John the Divine while she was battling cancer. I mean, she got her chemotherapy that morning and came to explain to me why St. John's, the Church of St. John the Divine's expansion was a bad idea for the community. Ray Rogers is a labor activist who has a book about the devil that was Coca-Cola.
That's right. That's right.
Diane Wolfstein, Viola Plummer, who's one of the great civil rights icons, very radical,
right.
But really a real, you know, been at it for all these years, has not changed one bit. And Mercedes Ellington.
Did you get pushback from editors when you would say, hey, I'm going to write about Viola Plummer this week? Anybody say, well, who's she, or something?
Well, I don't think they knew who she was. You know, I don't think they paid that much attention. You know, the only time I had pushback on what I wrote about, there was a guy who who wore women's clothes and would dance out in Queens Village. And he would dance on the sidewalk. Big, tall, flowing hair, and he had these short dresses on. And I'm trying to remember Elliot's last name. Elliot, if you hear this, please give me a call and let us know what your last name. But that's the only time they gave me some stuff about it, because they didn't think we should put a cross-dresser in the paper, which I thought was strange in New York City, but okay.
Well, times have changed. Well, those are some great people to be able to sit down and talk to. And you recorded those? Is that what you told me, that you would run your tape recorder?
Oh, yes, I have hundreds of hours of tape with folks. Because, listen, you think you can keep up with folks writing in your notebook as you're interviewing someone. But if you're writing like me and people speak so quickly, of course you can't keep up, and when you get back you have nothing but scrawls there, right? Because you can't even make out what they said because you don't know what you wrote. So I found it was easy just to tape everyone. The problem, of course, that is then you have to get back and transcribe all that stuff.
Right.
But the good part for me, I had great people on one day and City Beat on another, so I could have time in between to transcribe the tape. So I was able to get some really, really good interviews with some really great people.
That's wonderful. Okay, the greatest damn job in journalism. I believe it.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Before you became a columnist, right, I mean, you paid a lot of dues covering, I think, the kind of grim stories that newspapers are usually filled with. And I know you were in Atlanta at the time of the child murders there. In fact, I just took a look at it. You're featured in the recent HBO documentary about that terrible period. More than two dozen deaths, most of them, all of them, African-American kids and youths. How do you cover an incredibly wrenching story like that without burning out or just losing your will to go out of the newsroom and knock on another door where somebody's lost a child?
Well, it costs you something. It costs you something, man. But that's the cost of doing the job, right? I mean, if you're going to go, I've always felt that if you're going to go and ask someone questions at the worst moment of their lives, right, then it should cost you something. If it doesn't cost you anything, then something's wrong with you. If you can, I always hated to be in a room with, the prize of the interview was always the parents, right? After the mother, usually, because most times there wasn't a father in the house. Many of these kids were, many of them were not street kids, but they were hustlers. I mean, one guy, the first kid, I went out to his house. He was collecting bottles. Back in the day, you would walk down the side of a high. I did it when I was growing up as well in Charleston. We would walk down the side of the highway or street. And everyone would, when they bought you, had big old Coke and all the soda bottles. You would throw them, drink them, and throw them out the window or on the side of the street. So you pick them up and you redeem them. Well, these kids did the same thing. They would pick it up and redeem these bottles as a way to have some money, some pocket change, whatever. I went to the house in Bankhead Homes, in Bankhead Houses, project outside on the northwest side of Atlanta. And my city editor, Joe Dolman, who I actually ended up working with here at New York Newsday again, Joe sent me out there. And after the first time the kid's body has been found, and I was trying to figure out how to get in this house. And I said, I stopped by and he's got some flowers. I took the flowers and knocked on the door and told them I just brought the flowers. They said, "Well, what do you want? What do you want to say?" I said, "I just want to sit with y'all. I don't want to ask you any questions. I just want to sit. You can talk if you want to, or just let me sit with you for a while." And that was the story. I sat and watched them, put together dinner and talk amongst themselves about losing this child. Another woman, she was in her 50s and her son had been killed in the child murders, and I remember asking when we went to her house, the quote that she gave me that haunted me, that still haunts me every time I think about it. And she said, "I feel like I was a ball of paper. I was a piece of paper that somebody just balled up and threw in the trash after she lost her son." And she wasn't going to have any other kids. She was in her 50s, and she was all alone. And it's just one of those things that still stays with me. So long and short of it, it's supposed to cost you something. That's the only way it matters, right, if it costs you something.
Well, it's supposed to cost you something. That's probably a good word. It's a compelling documentary, by the way, multi-part. I commend it to people to take a look at the recent HBO documentary on that. I thought it was pretty good. I don't know about the conclusions. Do you have any strong feelings about that?
Well, Sam Pollard has done some amazing work. He did Eyes on the Prize back with that documentary that won all those about the Civil Rights Movement back in the day. And his resume is amazing. And he had... when he was doing this, he got in touch with some folks who were in Atlanta, and they got in touch with him, and then he got in touch with me, and we spoke about it. They wanted, I thought that the piece was good, but I think they felt for the competition from other documentarians who they wanted to come up with something new. So they tried to say that the Ku Klux Klan may have been responsible for some of these. And that anybody who was in Atlanta back then knew that, look, no... black folks could barely get into black neighborhoods without getting stopped by black people asking, "Wait, who are you? Where are you going? What are you doing?" Da da da. The white guys weren't going to be able to get in there and snatch those kids. That wasn't going to happen.
Mm. All right.
But that was the conclusion at the end of it. Otherwise, it was a good documentary.
Yeah. No, it's a good watch. I really and your take is terrific, I thought.
Well, thank you.
This show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, and I'm talking to the great Clem Richardson, veteran reporter and columnist. We're here on WBAI 99.5 FM. So here's a surprise mystery question. I'm not sure exactly what he had in mind, but when I posted the notice for this show on Facebook, one of your many fans, Tom Mayer, who I know you worked with at Newsday at least, said, be sure to ask you about the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, what about the Chicago Sun-Times?
Tom and I worked together the first time I lived in Chicago, and I was a Southern boy. When I moved up there with my first wife and I moved up there from Atlanta, the gentleman at the Sun-Times, who was the recruiter, Earl Moses, Earl tried to get me up there right after I got the job in Atlanta, and I turned him down. And then when I finally did come, it turned into I love the Sun-Times. It was just the first tabloid I ever worked for. It was funky. We had folks like Art Patak and Hugh Hoff. Of course, Mike Rocco was over at the Tribune. Everybody met down at the Billy Goat Tavern. The Saturday Night Live folks talk about the Billy Goat Tavern. That was actually real. That actually happened. The guy had kept a goat in this tavern. And Chicago was just a scream. Hal Washington had just been the first black mayor of Chicago, and it was a raucous time, man. A lot of fun.
For folks who are wondering what the Billy Goat Tavern was, tell me if I've got this right. It was the Chicago Sun-Times created its own bar as a one sting operation to see how many people showed up with their hands out.
The Billy Goat was an actual tavern made by, I think, the Mirage Bar was the one that just started. Hugh Hoff, the guy who became, what's his name? Oh, Lord, I can see his face. The editor of the Daily News, he moved from Chicago to come here, and he ran the Daily News for a while. They had this project, and they created the Mirage Bar, and it was just a textbook case of showing corruption throughout the system, from inspections to builders. Everybody had their hand out. Everybody was taking the bribes. Everybody was letting them pass and stuff. It was an amazing series of stories that they wrote. And did some really good work. But sometimes it's good like that. I mean, they understood the city, just like Daily News here in the New York Times. It was the Sun-Times and the Trib there. You know, here, Daily News is a lot closer to the street than New York Times is, and gives you an entirely different take on the city, if you're willing to read it and take it in.
Hold that thought for a second, because you said that the Sun-Times was your first tabloid after being on a couple very established broadsheets, because you also worked at the Miami Herald. What is the difference between a tabloid and a broadsheet, just in terms of the, it's all news. Why are they so different?
Well, the broadsheet will speak to you in this manner and say, this is something you should be concerned about, and I will tell you why you should be concerned about it. The tabloid say, hey, look, hey, this is, you gotta worry about this. The tabloids, I love tabloids because, you know, they kind of, they're like working class folks saying working class things and doing working class stuff. I think where we got away from accepting that that's what a tabloid is supposed to do is where we started getting in trouble. But the tabloid is a lot more pushy around kind of thing than big August papers that want to stand on their reputation and trot out their Pulitzers. The tabloids, you want the nice to win the prize, but it's a lot better if you can get the mayor impeached.
Well, speaking of your next tabloid was actually over at the news. We used to call it the tabloid in a tutu.
Everybody.
that was what Gil Spencer called it, the former Daily News editor.
Yes, it's tough too. We still call it that.
But maybe it's because it's been gone for almost 30 years, I guess now. But New York Newsday still stands out as a kind of model of what a city newspaper can be, could be. And it was a tabloid, but it also dug deeply into the issues, you know, the nuts and bolts of crime, politics. Did that feel different to you as well?
The Newsday was interesting. The Newsday was really, really interesting and a lot of fun because most of us were from out of town, right? I mean, but we came up here to work. I mean, I moved to New York to work there, and a lot of my fellow New York Newsday colleagues moved here to work there. But when we walk in the door, and who do you have? You have Don Force, who this little, kind of Italian-looking guy, sharp dresser, who left every day to go work out at the gym with his trainer for lunch and came back afterwards for the meeting at 3 o'clock with his, he had his towel around his neck and his shirt on and sitting in the meeting. And Don would pass these nasty little notes sometime that, hey, look at what this one is. I mean, Don would be up on sexual harassment charges day after tomorrow if he was, still alive and still working the newspaper. I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, the notes, I still have some of the notes over here somewhere that he passed me. But then we had Murray Kempton, Jimmy Breslin, Dennis Duggan, Dennis Hamill. I mean, just an array of New York writers. You were iconic and who were writing real stuff. I mean, they were excited about the city. I mean, I couldn't believe that Murray Kempton would jump on his bicycle to work, man. He'd go on a story on his bike. He'd roll up his one pants leg and put that sock over that pants leg so it didn't get caught in the spokes of his bike as he was pedaling. And he'd just go on. And I don't know how old Murray was. Then he died in 97 while I was away on the fellowship in South Africa. But it was such an exciting time. There are many of those folks went on to, of course, various newsrooms. I mean, Wendell Jameson ended up at the New York Times. I mean, so many of them. Wendell Jameson, Kevin Flynn, Bob, so many folks anyway. As a paper, I think they went over to the New York Times and to the Daily News, as I did.
So while you were there at Newsday, you were around during some of the really tough racial strife that the city was, the state and the city were going through, including things like the Tawana Brawley case and the Yusuf Hawkins murder. And how did you feel the paper did in its coverage of those, kind of tough events to just be able to put down in a simple news story? How did they do, do you think?
That's a really good question. How did they do with Tawana? I think we did pretty well. I mean, the early on, there was a belief that she was telling, that she was telling the truth. And we covered it like she was telling the truth. I mean, I remember going on taking a bus up to Poughkeepsie where they were marching with some of the marchers from down here. I remember sitting there in this one of these little rental buses that was so small. And, I'm 6'5", so trying to frame to pull myself into these little seats, and then the guy in front of me let the seat back and smashed my knees, and so I that's what I remember about the trip. But the racial, it's interesting covering Tawana. We would go to, you remember when her mother and her took sanctuary in the churches here in town, and it was such a kind of sensitive issue, racially sensitive time.
She was trying to avoid a subpoena, right, to appear in grand jury.
She was running with some subpoena. They were trying to subpoena her to get her to testify as to what was going on, right? And so we would go to these various churches, and folks would, some folks, the organizers of this, Al Sharpton and crew
Alton Maddox
understood us, what we were doing, Alton Maddox, C. Vernon Mason. Right. They all understood what we were trying to do, but sometimes the public would think just the press was the press was the press was the press, and would think that we were enemies of Tuan and enemies of her mother and enemies of all this stuff. And that, so it would sometimes become difficult. The most difficult time we had was she was in Bethany Baptist Church over here in Brooklyn. And I think Les Payne, the Newsday columnist on the island, had just written a piece saying he did not believe her anymore, that he thinks they were lying and they were making it up. So Al, from the podium, decided to make an example of us and told all of us the Newsday before to stand up. So we stood up and
said he was.
There was a one woman, Juliet Fairley. She was an intern at the paper, and she was sitting next to me. And when he said, all newspapers, news people stand up, she said, I said, no, you sit down. Sit down. Don't you want to stand up? So one of the attendants came over to the row, and he tried to reach around me to grab her to make her stand up. So I grabbed his hand and put it back and said, no, I'm standing up. She doesn't have to. And they all saw that, and they kicked us all out of the church. They just told us all to go. So we had a good story about us getting kicked out of the church. But New York is an interesting place racially, right? I mean, the shame to me has always been that we lived in such peace that it's a shame we let people make us seem like we can't get along. You know,
What do you mean by that, Clint?
I mean, everybody's here. Everybody from somewhere in the country is here. From somewhere in the world is here in New York, and the confines of 8.4 million of us here in New York City comes from all over the globe, right? And we get along every day. We get along most times. I mean, think of that. 8.4 million people moving around, making lives, growing, you know, raising families, attending community events, going about their business, and most days nothing happens untoward to most of us. Something always happens to some of us because there are 8.4 million of us here. So we understand that things are going to happen to some of us here. Some of us are going to have less than perfect experiences, plus, especially since many of us moving about the city are mentally ill and have reasons to be mentally ill. Some of us suffered great trauma. Some of us are homeless and living in very difficult situations. Some of us are having great difficulty just manipulating life, because that's how life is. Some people do well. Some people have harder times than others. But New York, for the most part, we live together really well, really well. But that's not what you would think from the news sometimes. That's not what you think from how we cover the news, how we present the news. We just think that we're living in a war zone. I mean, just this weekend, I think I saw, this weekend, last weekend, we saw all these things talking about, the shootings around New York, the violence out of hand. Well, you know, how many of the 8.4 million of us are affected by those shootings directly, right? Those people who lose, folks who are shot, the people living, unfortunately, live in those communities who are victims of this kind of violence. Yes. And we should be concerned for those people and about those people and about those communities, because no one should have to live like that. But the way it's termed and the way it's played on the news nowadays makes it sound as though New York is going under in police shootings. But that brought me to another idea as well. See, we have to start thinking about the groups that have a vested interest in making us think that the city is unsafe. If people have a vested interest in you thinking that you're unsafe, because then you will allow them to do what they need to do to make you feel safe. One of the great things that no one ever mentioned about why stop and frisk was so heinous a policy and continues to be such a heinous policy is that a simple logical conclusion. If you are able to stop your police officers and stop 670,000 people in 1 year, I think that's the 2016, 2017, before de Blasio cut back on, had them cut back on stopping prison. If you can stop that many people, what that actually means is that your cops got nothing to do, right? They have to be free to stop. They have to have time to stop these people. So what does that mean? There's not that kind of crime. The cops have time. That means there's not that crime. But the perception is somehow that we have to stop you, to help stop these people, to protect you. Of course, that's ludicrous. You have to stop them because you're bored and you have nothing to do. So why not stop them?
All right. We're going to pick up on that in a moment. Let's take a short music break. Reggie Johnson, you got our tune queued up there, please? Everybody knows that one. Time is tight, Booker T and the MGs. I always thought that tune should be piped into the newsroom at Deadline because it was something about that pulsing Booker T organ and Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper. It really it sort of makes you push to keep typing and, you know, see what happens. So, you know, you were talking just before we broke there. This is, the show is Deadline NYC, I remind people, and I'm talking to veteran reporter and columnist Clem Richardson, who just before the break was making an awful lot of sense about some stuff that goes wrong in the way we report the news. We're going to talk some more about that at the Daily News. Let me ask you. So we called ourselves right up top on the masthead New York's hometown paper. Mm-hmm. But it often felt to me, the longer I was there, that editors, publishers, I don't know, that they had this outdated image of the hometown and the readers. It was like it was still Jackie Gleason land, you know, the honeymooners.
Yes, yes.
You know, the news folded over and tucked in front of the windshield as he drove the bus, you know, as opposed to what was clearly, you know, a growing black and brown majority in the city. And, you know, I remember having discussions with editors about that a little bit. Did you as well? Was that something that you felt when you were working at the Daily News, which was, itself New York's hometown paper?
You know, you always did felt that disconnect, right? I mean, the time I realized how disconnected we were from the city in a way, well, it always rears its head with black people, right? Because you remember when we put the picture of the young man who was shot at the one time someone actually was shot at the West Indian Day Parade,
yes,
and someone got on top of a bus or on a truck and shot a picture down of this young man laying on the ground, and you can see the blood in his head, you know, coming out of the blood puddle near his head, and we actually put that on the front page of the paper. You know, we you know, when to be black at the Daily News is always interesting. Oftentimes, rears its head in ways that really would disturb you. I mean, we, you know, the there seemed to be a real reticence to see the black community as a complete thing, right? As a full bodied thing. I mean, as people, good people, bad people. Folks trying to make communities, folks really having lives and having good lives as a community. There was always this tendency to stereotype it and see it in a certain way. We always had, getting back to West Indian American Parade, but we always had a problem, and it still goes on, that, listen, anybody, if you let somebody pull out a gun on the Labor Day weekend anywhere in Brooklyn, and they're going to say, somebody's going to try to relate it to the violence associated with West Indian Day Carnival. And, of course, that's a lie. It's not true. And the another thing you see with the carnival, if you've been out there, you would think it's always a black thing from the way the papers and the TV stations cover it. But go out there on Labor Day and see who's out there. My wife and I, when we have, you know, that's sort of a young person's game, right? Because there's a lot of people. I mean, we, those, you know, as we get older, let me go amongst these million people and get knocked around and try to see if I can get my hand on my wife's hand or my kids or whatever while I'm out there. But we don't need to do that as much. But my wife and I went out there about 4 years ago. You should see that everybody's out there. right. Blacks, but a lot of white folks, a lot right. of Hispanic folks, a lot of Asian folks. And what are they doing? They're eating the food. They're walking up and down the street. They're dancing behind the favorite floats. They're having a ball. Nobody's thinking about race and about all this thing. But as you look at the pictures in the papers and even on TV, you would think it was the all-black thing. And that's the shame of it. And I think media oftentimes has not accepted the fullness of who we are as New Yorkers. You know, you keep trying to, the organizations themselves keep trying to stereotype what it is, instead of just going out and seeing it for what it is, which is a really beautiful thing,
mm-hmm.
and inclusive. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I was always recognizing how many of the folks who were running the newsroom were stepping off of the LIRR or at Penn Central at Grand Central Station, as opposed to, you know, taking the A train or something.
But the other problem is now, of course, you know, newspapers paid, but they didn't pay that well that we could afford. A lot of people could afford to live in the city, just like cops and everybody else. You know, we can't afford to live here, but I understand what you mean. I mean, the other thing, you know what told me what we really were missing in the paper? Remember the famous song, was it Wingo or Zingo fiasco when the...
Wingo.
The news. You remember Wingo?
I've repressed that memory, but go ahead.
They printed, they included these kind of scratch-off lottery tickets as part of the Wingo contest. And you scratch off the numbers, each number that came every day in the paper, and it will tell you if you won or not. But unfortunately, the stupid person who either designed it or printed it, every ticket won. It was supposed to only win if you scratched off the numbers you saw, whatever the letters, whatever you're supposed to scratch off. But of course, people just saw the scratch off. They scratched it all off, and all you saw what everybody wants. So they remember the stream of people coming down to the paper. Oh, man, the folks coming in. This one guy, I remember, he chartered a limo, man. He had like five girls in the car, and the limo came over there drinking champagne because they thought they won $1 million. She thought he'd won $1 million. And I remember passing the guy as I was leaving. Who is it? Somebody called the broken down horse trader, or somebody broken down horse bed, or something like that. Cartoonist Bill.
Bill Gallagher.
What's his name? Bill. Was
Bill Gallagher.
Muhammad Ali friend. He actually does, and I feel bad, but Bill used to talk about these guys. Well, this guy was coming on TV. He had on some plaid pants and a different kind of plaid jacket, and then he had a white shirt, and he had this little off-color tie that he had obviously drawn on and pulled real tight, and he's coming on the street with that Wingo thing rolled up in his hand, walking because he just knew he'd won as well. And those are New Yorkers. Those were the Daily News readers, right? Those are the
right.
people I think we did not really accept as the folks who were reading us and the folks right. who were keeping us in business.
I've completely repressed the Wingo. What did the Post have? Zingo? They had their own thing.
It was horrible. I mean, you felt bad for those people. And, of course, I was totally out of touch with the office politics because I go in the news media and say, well, when are we going to end this crazy shit? I'm sorry. I'm going to end this crazy thing. And the editor looked at me like, everybody looked at me, is he crazy? It's like, forget I said that. Yeah. It was crazy. It was crazy time. But the news, I mean, I don't know. You know, Tom, you've been there. In fact, you've had more of these arguments than I've had because you've always been pushing for the organization to do better. See, I'm used to the organization not responding to my complaints because folks, it was up until now, until 2020, 2021, almost up until George Floyd, folks felt as though they knew better, right? Folks felt that, well, it's our way. You know, I own this, I run this, I should do things my way, da-da-da-da-da. Only now that integration has actually worked, right? And that's that's the problem the Republican Party is having right now, is that integration in the 60s actually worked. When we started going home, going to schools together, going to organizations, working in organizations together. I mean, that means you started hanging out. You started drinking together. You started dating. You started having kids together. So your image of the world is different. When you know people, when you know people of different color, ethnicity, you realize there's nothing to fear there, right? They're just people like us. They're as nice or as twisted or as mean or as beautiful as anyone of any race. You realize it doesn't really matter. And that's the Republican Party problem now, is realizing that as we try to, that's why they have to flake off and try to get support out in rural America, where these small homogeneous communities can pretend that integration didn't work. And mm-hmm. I think the papers are the same victims of that they didn't. We had it to keep, but we kept doing the same things we'd done all the time and got us where we are. But if you look at Schnepp's communication, you look at Vicki Schnepp's out there in Queens.
You're talking about the Schnepp's, which has taken over most of the local papers, right?
Most of the local papers. They're doing well because people want to know what's happening in their neighborhood. People want to know what's going on down the street. People want to know what's the giveaway, what's on sale at the store. People really do. And we could have had that. We could have kept that. We could have done that, but that was deemed as small town. And look at us now. I mean, I'd be surprised. I wrote a piece the other day that I finally just put on, a wire service myself, Iron Press Wire, to get out, saying that I was afraid that when the Daily News announced that they were not going back down to their offices, that they were going to put the paper out from now on from their employees' homes. Well, I felt and I still feel that there's a good possibility that means the paper's going to go under, the paper's going to disappear. And right. If the paper disappears, then who do we have left? See, people don't understand how important these papers are to what they know about their city. They don't really appreciate how central newspapers, especially local newspapers, the Times somewhat, but the Times doesn't cover local news like the Daily News and the Post is. People don't understand that every other news outlet more or less gets its news from what used to get its news from what's in Daily News, what's in the Post, because those are the papers with the more reporters closer to the ground covering these stories. Those are the papers that people know to call if you want your local issue covered.
Well, let me just stop you, because I want to make sure folks get this point, because I think it's a pretty important one. People who work for, like, the radio stations, for the TV stations, cable news stations, the assignment editors start the day by trying to figure out what to cover. And
right.
where do they get their ideas about what to cover? Go ahead, fill in the blank.
That's right, exactly. That's exactly right. They get it from the Daily News. They buy the paper every day on the way. And a friend of mine used to be a CNN producer. She said, no, you get the paper as soon as you either deliver it at your house or there at the office, and you sit down and you clip the stories and you take the clip, you cut it out, literally cut it out of the paper, walk it over to the reporter, put it on the desk, okay, replicate that. But do this story, go out and do this story. Well, if the Daily News is now down to, I think it was 40-something people covering the city of 8.4 million, well, you're not getting out like you were before. You don't have the feet on the ground, you know, the troops who are storming around the city, finding, talking to people and having things told you. So you don't have those things in the paper, and you don't have those things then reflected in other news media. You don't have it online like you should. You don't have it in television and radio stations, but they don't have reporters going in. And in fact, TV, I have to tell you, I'm terrified of the 6 o'clock news, because I think it's the greatest threat to the city.
Well, play that out a little bit when you say you're terrified and it's the greatest threat. I mean, we're talking to, let me just remind people, this is Deadline NYC, where we're talking about the news business. My name's Tom Robbins, WBAI FM 99.5, and that's Clem Richardson making a lot of sense there, a really great veteran reporter and columnist. Go ahead. Why does it terrify you? What are you talking about?
Well, listen, watch the news now. If you watch the 6 o'clock news, the news is formatted news is now formatted, right? It's not news. It's not the news. It's not a program that gives you the news that you need to know. It's a program that now tailors the news to fit its format. So the first few stories will be some crime news or some breaking event news, some car wreck or some shooting, some fire, something like that. Then the next one will be a little blurb to the weather, and they'll tell you what's coming, da-da-da. Then they'll go back and use these another crime kind of thing, crime news or city government news again, the mayor or someone else talking about some, usually someone complaining about city government more after the city government doing something. Then it breaks out to come back to the weather, and then they always go out with some little bright, you know.